Welcome back to the Kurdish Research Audio Archive. Today we're taking a look into the historical currents that really shaped Kurdish identity and, you know, the aspirations for self-determination, leading right up to the late 1970s. We'll be examining a range of sources to try and understand the key factors at play during this, well, really pivotal period. Our aim is to pull out the crucial understandings of Kurdish nationalism, where it actually started, how it evolved across Turkey, Iran, Iraq, Syria.
Right, the four main regions.
Exactly. And the major forces that guided its path. We'll unpack the core ideas, the significant events, and of course, the persistent challenges that marked this journey.
Sounds good. It's a complex story.
It really is. Let's start maybe back in the 19th century, looking at those initial stirrings of Kurdish nationalism.
Okay.
It's quite remarkable how Kurdistan emerged then as a movement asserting Kurdish nationhood, ultimately envisioning an independent Kurdistan covering those Kurdish majority areas we recognize today.
It is. But what's fascinating to remember is that, you know, the early 19th century, there wasn't a unified political Kurdistan. Kurdish areas were split between the Ottoman and Qajar empires.
Right.
But within those empires, you had these semi-autonomous Kurdish principalities, the Emirates. You know, like Bitlis, Hakkari, Botan, Badenan, Soran, Baban under the Ottomans.
And Ardalan, Mukri under the Qajars?
Exactly. And they were run by mirs or emirs who had quite a bit of self-rule. And, importantly, they fostered Kurdish culture in their territories.
So these emirates kind of acted as incubators for Kurdish culture and a memory of self-governance.
Precisely. Their existence and then later their dismantling created this memory, this idea of having ruled themselves, which definitely fueled later desires for a unified national identity.
It sounds like within those smaller sort of independent areas, Kurdish cultural expression could really thrive.
It could, to an extent.
But then the big empire started to centralize. That changed things, didn't it?
Oh, absolutely. The Ottoman Empire's push for centralization, particularly during the Tanzimat era, that's roughly 1839 to 1876, aimed squarely at dismantling these emirates.
When did that mostly happen?
The main push was between about 1834 and 1847. By the middle of the century, they were effectively destroyed.
And that destroyed the traditional power structures.
Yes, it created a real power vacuum.
And as usually happens, something else fills that void.
It does. Initially, it was religious leaders, the sheikhs, from the Qadiri and Naqshbandi Khalidi orders who gained influence.
Okay.
Then later in the century, tribal chieftains, the agas, became more prominent, especially through Sultan Abdulhamid II's Hamidi-like cavalry regiments.
Yes, the Hamidi, formed in 1890.
That's right, largely made up of Kurdish tribesmen loyal to the Sultan. This shift in leadership also, you know, subtly changed how early Kurdish resistance manifested itself.
That's interesting. So this evolving leadership shaped early resistance. It sounds like it was a mix defending old privileges, regional power plays, but also this sort of growing ethnic consciousness.
That's a really crucial point. It's easy to look back and label everything as nationalism, but a lot of these early movements were, well, primarily about protecting existing power.
Mm-hmm.
Take Abdurrahman Pasha of the Baban Emirate. His rebellion in 1806, it seems more geared towards getting greater autonomy for his own emirate, not really full independence for all Kurds.
So more local power struggles than a unified national dream at that stage.
For many, yes. But these revolts, even if localized, did bring the Kurdistan question, as it were, to the attention of the Ottoman and Persian states, maybe even some European powers.
Okay, so they highlighted Kurdish distinctiveness, even if not fully nationalist yet.
Exactly. They laid some groundwork. Then you see a really significant shift with Sheikh Ubeydullah of Neri, his uprising in 1879-1880.
Yes, that one's often pointed to as a key moment, a real turning point.
It is. Sheikh Ubeydullah's movement is, I think, widely seen as the first clear, modern expression of Kurdish nationalism. He wasn't just asking for local privileges. He explicitly demanded political autonomy, maybe even full independence from both Ottoman and Persian interference.
Right. Wanting a Kurdistan free from outside control, that's a big step.
A huge departure from earlier resistance, yeah.
But it wasn't successful in the end.
No, unfortunately not. The Ottomans suppressed the uprising and Sheikh Ubeydullah was exiled. But the ideas he voiced and the scale of his movement, they definitely had a lasting impact. They inspired later generations.
Following that, towards the end of the 19th, early 20th century, we see this rise of intellectual Kurdish nationalism. That feels like another critical phase.
Absolutely critical.
Yeah.
This is where you see Ottoman Kurdish intellectuals, civil servants, military officers, doctors, many educated in Istanbul or even Europe, getting exposed to European nationalist ideas.
Ah, so they start framing Kurdish identity in more modern political terms.
Exactly. They begin conceptualizing and articulating Kurdish nationhood in that way. This intellectual awakening was vital. It provided a more defined ideology for that growing nationalist feeling.
So these are the people starting to define what Kurdishness meant politically at the time.
Precisely. And they started forming the first Kurdish cultural groups, political organizations, and crucially, publishing things to spread their ideas.
Like newspapers.
Yes, the first Kurdish newspaper, Kurdistan, published in Cairo in 1898. It was started by descendants of the exiled Prince Bedirksen, a landmark moment for spreading nationalist ideas and building that shared identity.
It's amazing to think of those early newspapers planting seeds, but I remember reading that even within this intellectual circle, there wasn't total agreement on the goals.
That's right. Right from the start, there were internal divisions. Some, like the Bedirksen family you mentioned, were pushing hard for full independence, a sovereign Kurdish state. But others, particularly figures from powerful sheikh families, like Sayyid Abdulkadir, who was Sheikh Ubaidullah's son, leaned more towards autonomy within the existing empires, Ottoman or Persian.
So that classic split between full independence and autonomy was there right from the beginning.
It was. And unfortunately, that divergence in strategy would become a recurring problem for the Kurdish movement.
Oh. Henna the Chai Lady is here. Rodbosh.
Rodbosh.
Ah, wonderful.
Hannah, you brought us chai. Oh, this smells fantastic. Just what we needed, I think.
It really does. A welcome pause. Thanks, Hannah.
Let's see. Oh, Hannah, this is really good today. It's not bitter at all, just right sweetness-wise. Is that extra cardamom I taste? It's lovely and warm.
Yes, this is a very nice batch. Much better than that time. It was a bit too strong, remember?
Oh, definitely. Last week's needed a bit more sugar for me. But this, yeah, this is spot on. Thank you, Hannah.
Yes, thank you. This will keep us going. Okay, fueled by some excellent chai, let's move into the period around World War I and the Treaty of Sèvres. This seems like a time of massive upheaval, destruction, but also a brief, flickering moment of hope for Kurds.
Absolutely. The collapse of the Ottoman Empire after the war definitely created a perceived window. Self-determination seemed possible for lots of groups, including the Kurds.
But the war itself was devastating for Kurdish areas.
Terrible devastation. Military conflict, scorched earth tactics. It was brutal. And the Treaty of Sèvres, even though it never actually happened, became this powerful symbol of hope, dashed, really embedding a sense of betrayal that fueled later movements.
And the political climate inside the late Ottoman Empire itself wasn't exactly welcoming to non-Turkish groups anyway, was it?
No, not at all. The Committee of Union and Progress, the CUP, who were basically in charge, were pushing this radical Turkish nationalism,
right,
which naturally fueled anti-Ottoman feelings among Kurds and other minorities facing oppression, forced resettlement, things like that.
Then comes Sèvres in 1920. And my understanding is it actually offered something pretty significant on paper for the Kurds.
It did, remarkably so. Articles 62 to 64 specifically laid out provisions for an autonomous Kurdish region in southeastern Anatolia.
Autonomy, initially.
Yes, with the possibility of full independence within a year, if the Kurdish population wanted it and the League of Nations approved. There was even talk of including the Kurds in the Mosul Vilayet, which shows the British influence there.
So, for a moment, there's this potential Kurdistan mapped out, at least in theory. But the proposed borders weren't perfect.
No, they weren't comprehensive. Notably, the Van region, with its large Kurdish population, was left out, which kind of highlights the incomplete nature of what was being proposed.
And as we know, Sèvres never actually got implemented. Why did it fail? What were the main reasons?
Well, it was a convergence of factors, really. The biggest one was the Turkish War of Independence, led by Mustafa Kemal Atatürk. He flat out rejected the Allied plan to partition Anatolia.
Okay, Turkish resistance was key.
Absolutely. But also, Allied imperial rivalries didn't help. Bolshevik Russia supported the Turkish nationalists. And frankly, there wasn't a completely unified Kurdish leadership or strategy ready to fully capitalize on that brief opportunity.
So a mix of Turkish strength, international politics, and maybe some internal Kurdish disunity.
Exactly. And then the Treaty of Lausanne in 1923 completely replaced Sèvres. Lausanne formally recognized the Republic of Turkey within its new borders and, crucially, made zero mention of Kurdish autonomy.
And that sealed the division of Kurdish territories.
It did, between Turkey, Iran, Iraq, and Syria, a decision with incredibly profound and lasting consequences for the Kurdish people.
A huge blow to those early nationalist hopes. It must have felt like a profound betrayal.
It absolutely was. It became a central grievance, fueling Kurdish nationalism for decades. Mm-hmm. But even amidst all that turmoil and disappointment, you still see these early 20th century Kurdish nationalist organizations popping up, trying to find ways forward.
Can you tell us a bit about some of those key groups?
Sure. One of the earliest was the Kurd Society for Cooperation and Progress, around 1908-1909. Figures like Sheikh Abdulkadir, Emin Ali Bedir Khan were involved. Their focus was mainly cultural promotion, advocating for Kurdish rights within the Ottoman system. They even published that Kurdistan newspaper we mentioned earlier. But predictably, they were eventually banned.
So more cultural and rights-based within the empire initially?
Yeah. Then after World War I, you get the Society for the Elevation of Kurdistan, KTC, or AARSK, active from about 1918 into the early 20s. This group, including Sheikh Abdulkadir again, members of the Bedir Khan family, Sharif Pasha, they aimed higher, self-determination.
More ambitious.
Definitely. But they were divided internally, autonomy versus full independence. They did important work, though, lobbying at the Paris Peace Conference, publishing the Jin magazine, but again, eventually banned.
And then Zhoibun comes along later, in the late 20s, early 30s. They seem more focused on independence.
Zhoibun, active from 27 to 46, yes. They represented a much more clearly nationalist, secular Republican vision, straight up advocating for Kurdish independence. Key figures were Seledet and Kamran Bedirksen. Zhoibun was the force behind the Ararat Rebellion, a major attempt to set up an independent Kurdish state. They really tried to get international support, too.
We keep hearing that name, Bedirksen. That family seems to have played a massive role in the early movement.
They really did. They were major proponents of independence, very active in journalism, leadership roles in several key organizations. Other key figures from this period, Sharif Pasha, representing Kurds at Paris, Sheikh Abdulkadir, who started seeking autonomy but was later executed, Ihsan Nuri Pasha, the military leader of the Ararat Rebellion, even someone like Sed Nursi had early links to Kurdish organizing.
And what were the big intellectual ideas shaping these groups?
Well, several things were swirling around. The collapse of the Ottoman millet system, which had given some community autonomy.
Right.
The rise of this intense Turkish nationalism pushing others out. The whole Wilsonian self-determination idea after WWI. Huh? And just the development of a distinct Kurdish ethno-national identity, sometimes drawing on European ideas about nations and ethnicity. It was all feeding into it.
It sounds like a really dynamic time, lots of different ideas bubbling up. But you mentioned earlier the problem of internal divisions kept coming back.
Yes, unfortunately. Yeah. These early groups were really hampered by disagreements. Ideology, strategy, especially that core question, autonomy or independence. Plus, you had internal factionalism, often based on old family or regional ties, and sometimes a disconnect between the leaders, often in exile, and the people back home. These internal weaknesses became tragically a recurring theme.
So as we move into the interwar period and the mid-20th century, these nationalist hopes are now playing out inside the borders of these new, often hostile nation-states. Let's start with Turkey and the Kavalis Project. How did that impact Kurds?
In Turkey, under Ataturk, it was all about building a homogeneous Turkish nation. This meant intense Turkish nationalism and Turkification policies. Kurdish ethnic identity was actively denied. They were officially called Mountain Turks. The Kurdish language, culture, all suppressed in public life, schools.
That forceful assimilation must have caused huge resentment.
Oh, absolutely. And it led to significant resistance. The Sheikh Sed Rebellion in 1925 was massive, led by a religious figure, yes, but fueled by opposition to secularism, that denial of identity, and nationalism, too.
How did the state respond?
Brutally. The military crushed it. Mass executions, huge displacements of Kurds. And it just led to more intense Turkification, things like the Report for Reform in the East, which basically laid out a plan for forceful assimilation.
And then there was the Ararat Republic in the late 20s. That seems like a more direct attempt at statehood.
It was a more organized effort, yes, between 1927 and 1931. Led by Zhoibun,
right,
with Ihsan Nuri Pasha as military commander. They even had a capital, Kurdoeva, tried to get international recognition.
But it didn't succeed.
No. Turkish diplomacy and military force shut it down by 1931. Smaller uprisings kept happening into the late 30s, but they were all repressed forcefully.
Okay, let's shift focus to Iraq under the British mandate. The situation sounds a bit different there, maybe more ambiguous because of British interests. Oil, perhaps?
Definitely more complex. Britain had huge strategic interests, especially in the oil-rich Mosul area, which had a lot of Kurds. So there were Initial promises about Kurdish rights in the new Iraqi state, the 1921 constitution, the 1932 local languages law.
But they weren't always fulfilled.
Often not. Arab nationalism was growing in Iraq and resisted it. Plus, there were practical difficulties. And the whole Mosul question, the dispute between Turkey and Britain-Iraq over the region, meant both sides were manipulating Kurdish leaders for their own ends.
And Iraq saw the Kingdom of Kurdistan under Sheikh Mahmoud Barzanji, another early attempt at self-rule.
A significant one, yes. Sheikh Mahmoud initially worked with the British, but then declared himself king. His aim for independence clashed with British interests, especially oil. So his kingdom, which existed roughly 1921-24 with a comeback in 25, was crushed. British air power played a big role alongside Iraqi forces. Later rebellions he led in the 30s were also put down.
Turning to Iran under the Pahlavis, how did Kurdish nationalism fare there, especially with Reza Shah's centralization?
Reza Shah from 1925 also pushed centralization and Persianization, a shift from the Qajars who'd allowed a bit more integration. The Simcoe-Shikak revolts in the northwest, mainly 1918-22 and again in 26, were significant. Simcoe, a tribal chief, controlled areas like Urmia for a time.
Was that an independence bid or more about his own power?
Historians debate that. Was it purely Kurdish independence or consolidating his tribal authority? Either way, the state suppressed it, and Simcoe was assassinated in 1930.
And then, of course, the Republic of Mahabad in 1946. Short-lived, but very important symbolically.
Extremely important. It popped up during the Anglo-Soviet occupation after WWII, led by Qazi Mohammed, the KDPI, Kurdistan Democratic Party of Iran. They aimed for autonomy within Iran, used Kurdish in schools and administration, tried to link up with the Soviet-backed Azerbaijan People's Government next door.
So heavily reliant on Soviet support.
Very much so. And that support was, well, shaky and didn't last. When the Soviets pulled out under Western pressure in mid-1946, Mahabad was exposed.
And the Iranian army moved in.
They did, in December 46. Qazi Mohammed and other leaders were arrested and tragically executed in March 1947. But Mahabad, despite failing, became this potent symbol of Kurdish self-rule aspirations in Iran.
It really seems like a pattern relying on external support, which then gets withdrawn, leading to suppression. What about Syria under the French mandate? That sounds like it might have been a slightly different environment initially.
It was distinct, yes. From 1920 to 1946, the French actually encouraged Kurdish settlement in the Jazeera region, northeast Syria, partly as a counterweight to Arab nationalism. They even gave citizenship to Kurdish refugees fleeing Turkey.
And Damascus became a hub for exiled leaders?
Yes, for Zoybun's political wing. Mm. And this period saw a real Kurdish cultural renaissance, especially in the Kurmanji dialect, led by figures like Seladet and Cameron Bedirksen. Publications like Hawar were huge, standardizing the Kurdish Latin alphabet, fostering national consciousness through language and culture. The idea was independence lies in our language.
So cultural associations flourished, too.
They did. Salah al-Din Club, Suwan and Kurd, French Mandate Syria sort of inadvertently became this incubator for Kurdish cultural nationalism.
So kind of paradoxically, Syria became a key center for Kurdish cultural development then.
For a time, yes. But it didn't last. Once Syria gained independence in 1946, the rising Arab nationalist ideology saw Kurdish aspirations as suspect, even hostile. That marked the start of marginalization and repression for Kurds in Syria.
It's quite sobering seeing these brief moments of self-rule flare up and then get extinguished, but how they become powerful symbols. And that recurring, risky reliance on external help seems central.
Absolutely. The interwar years and the post-WWII period really set the stage for the even more complex dynamics of Kurdish nationalism during the Cold War,
yeah,
with its own set of superpower rivalries and regional games.
Right. So moving into the Cold War era, from the 50s to the 70s, you have the U.S. versus the USSR dominating the global stage. How did that superpower rivalry impact Kurdish movements?
Massively. The Cold War context meant Kurdish movements were often seen and used purely through the lens of strategic interest by both superpowers and their regional allies. This led to that recurring cycle, conditional support, manipulation, and then abandonment when Kurdish goals didn't align with bigger geopolitical games.
Can you give an example?
Sure. The U.S. prioritized its alliances with Turkey and Iran, key anti-Soviet states. But it sometimes covertly backed Iraqi Kurds, like Barzani's KDP, to destabilize Iraq when it leaned towards the Soviets. But that support vanished overnight when the U.S. calculus changed, like with the 1975 Algiers Agreement between Iran and Iraq.
So the Kurds were pawns in a larger game.
Very often, yes. Soviet Union did similar things, backing Kurds in Iraq or Iran, sometimes to counter Western influence. But their policy was inconsistent, too. They had to balance supporting Kurds with maintaining state-to-state ties, like their 1972 treaty with Iraq.
And regional alliances didn't help either.
No. Things like the Baghdad Pact, later CENTO, were partly aimed at suppressing any movement, including Kurdish nationalism, that might destabilize member states. This external meddling, while sometimes offering temporary aid, often deepened internal Kurdish divisions and made a unified strategy much harder.
Okay, let's break down how these Cold War dynamics affected each region. Starting with Turkey, it sounds like this period saw the rise of leftist Kurdish nationalism, but also ongoing, even intensifying state repression.
That's a good summary. The 1950s, under the Democrat Party, saw a slight easing, maybe co-opting some traditional leaders. But the 1960 coup in the 61 Constitution, while bringing some general liberalization, also created space for Kurdish grievances to be voiced more openly. And this coincided with the rise of a more secular, leftist Kurdish movement, partly driven by social changes, more education, migration to cities.
Was the Workers' Party of Turkey, TP, involved?
Yes. TP, founded in 61, did address Kurdish issues. Significantly, in 1970, they passed a resolution recognizing Kurds as a separate nation. Big step. But TP had internal fights over the Kurdish question and got banned after the 1971 military intervention anyway.
And what about the DDKO, the Revolutionary Cultural Eastern Hearths?
The DDKO, founded in 69, was important. A left-wing platform for discussing the Kurdish question, demanding cultural freedom. They held seminars, published things. Abdullah Öcalan was apparently involved in some activities back then.
But they faced the same fate.
Yes. Banned after the 71 intervention. Leaders arrested, including figures like Musa Enter. It seems any organized Kurdish expression, left or otherwise, was met with suppression.
So alongside these banned groups, illegal parties emerged.
Exactly. Underground parties. The Democratic Party of Kurdistan in Turkey, TKDP, founded in 65, was significant. Inspired by Barzani's KDP in Iraq, it aimed for autonomy or independence, initially had some traditional support, but it also suffered internal splits. A radical left faction under Dr. Shivan pushed for armed struggle. Tragically, both Said Elka and Dr. Shivan were killed in Iraqi Kurdistan in 71, which really hurt the TKDP.
Were there other leftist groups, too?
Yes, quite a few smaller ones. Rizgari, Komal, TKSP, KPD, DKD, KK, often Marxist-Leninist or Maoist, seeing Kurdistan as colonized, proposing various revolutionary paths.
And the state's reaction after the 1971 intervention was particularly harsh.
Extremely harsh. Widespread crackdown on leftists and Kurds. Martial law in Kurdish areas, bans, mass arrests, torture allegations were common, renewed enforcement of the language and culture ban. This intense repression, arguably, pushed some towards more radical paths.
Is this the context where the PKK originates?
Precisely. It's in this climate of state violence and the seeming failure of peaceful politics that Kurdistan Workers' Party, PKK, started forming in the early to mid-70s. Among Kurdish students in Ankara, led by Abdullah Öcalan, known as APO, their ideology mixed Marxism-Leninism with strong Kurdish nationalism, aiming for an independent socialist Kurdistan via armed struggle. They formally founded the party in Fes Village in 1978.
And started armed actions soon after.
Yes, in the late 70s, initially targeting people they saw as state collaborators and also rival Kurdish groups.
Okay, turning to Iraq during the Cold War, it sounds like a cycle of failed autonomy talks, intense internal Kurdish rivalry, and being caught in regional power plays.
That sums it up well. The KDP, under Mustafa Barzani, remained dominant, nationalist but with deep tribal roots. Barzani returned from Soviet exile after the 58 revolution, which initially raised hopes.
But those hopes faded.
Yes. The Iraqi leader Qasim didn't deliver real autonomy. Then you had the first Iraqi-Kurdish war through the 60s. That led to the March 1970 Autonomy Agreement.
Which promised self-rule.
It did. Self-rule, Kurdish language rights, representation, but it fell apart over implementation, especially the status of Kirkuk and the Ba'athists' continued Arabization policies.
Leading to another war.
The second Iraqi-Kurdish war, 1974-75. This time, the KDP got covert backing from the U.S., Iran, and Israel. But, and this is crucial, that support was aimed at weakening Iraq, not achieving Kurdish independence.
And then came the Algiers Agreement in 1975.
The big betrayal, as Kurds saw it. Iran dropped support for Iraqi Kurds and returned for border concessions from Iraq. The U.S. and Israel followed suit. The Kurdish resistance collapsed almost overnight.
A devastating blow.
Absolutely. And in the aftermath, Saddam Hussein's Ba'athist regime ramped up repression, forced displacements, destroying villages, systematic Arabization.
And the emergence of the PUK in 1975 added another layer.
Yes, the Patriotic Union of Kurdistan, founded by Jalal Talabani and others, offered a leftist, more urban intellectual alternative to the KDP. But it also led to intense, often violent, conflict between Kurdish factions, which weakened them overall.
And Iran and Iraq just used Kurdish groups against each other.
Constantly. Both used Kurdish groups in the other country as proxies, with terrible consequences for Kurdish civilians caught in the middle.
A truly tragic situation. What about Iran during this Cold War period? We have the KDPI and the emergence of Komala.
In Iran, the KDPI, weakened after Mahabad, saw a brief revival under Mossadegh in the early 50s, but was repressed again after the 53 coup restored the Shah. They struggled internally, failed to unify with Barzani's KDP. A faction tried an uprising in 67-68, but it failed. The party got a boost in the 70s under Dr. Abdulrahman Gasemlu, who became leader in 73.
He shifted their ideology.
Yes, towards a more social democratic line. And they became active in the broader opposition to the Shah.
And Komala emerged around the same time.
Komala was founded in 69, though became public later. They were Marxist-Leninist, influenced by Maoism, focused on class struggle and national liberation for Iranian Kurds.
How did they fare after the 1979 Iranian Revolution?
Both KDPI and Komala were active in the Kurdish rebellion demanding autonomy right after the revolution. But the new Islamic Republic rejected those demands and launched a military crackdown. Both groups then took up arms against the state. But their relationship was tense ideological clashes, competition for influence. It even led to armed fighting between them in the 80s, which really hurt the overall Kurdish resistance in Iran. And, of course, both the Shah and the Islamic Republic used severe repression against any Kurdish activism.
Finally, Syria during the Cold War. It sounds like lots of small parties, Ba'athist repression, and policies like the Arab Belt.
That's right. The Kurdish political scene in Syria was fragmented. The Kurdistan Democratic Party of Syria, KDPS, started in 57, focused on cultural rights, economic progress, democracy within Syria, but it was underground, faced crackdowns early on, like in 1960, and was plagued by internal splits, ideology, leadership fights, influence from the KDP-PUK rivalry in Iraq. So lots of small, often ineffective groups emerged.
And the Ba'ath Party taking power was bad news for Kurds.
Very bad. They seized power in 63, Hafez al-Assad consolidated rule in 70. Their pan-Arab ideology saw Kurdish aspirations as a threat. This led to systematic Arabization and repression. A key moment was the 1962 special census in Hasaka province.
What did that do?
It arbitrarily stripped about 120,000 Syrian Kurds of their citizenship, made them stateless, ajanib or maktumin, denying basic rights.
Then they were built.
Launched in 73, basically demographic engineering along the Turkish border, expropriating Kurdish land, forcing displacement maybe 140,000 Kurds, and moving in Arab Bedouins into model villages.
Why? What was the goal?
To change the demographics, cut links between Syrian and Turkish Kurds, control resources, and stop any Kurdish separatism. The settlement part stopped in 76, but the discriminatory laws remained.
Plus general cultural suppression.
Oh, yes. Bans on Kurdish language and official use, schools, business, publishing, music banned, restrictions on cultural events, even Kurdish names often disallowed.
How did Kurds resist this, and how did the PKK fit in?
Well, the Syrian Kurdish parties operated clandestinely, pushing for rights. But in the late 70s, the PKK from Turkey started gaining influence among Syrian Kurds. And paradoxically, Assad's regime actually allowed the PKK to set up camps in Syria, using them as a weapon against Turkey. But this inadvertently strengthened Kurdish identity and nationalism within Syria itself, even if under a Turkish banner.
It really paints a bleak picture across the board. Systematic repression, denial of rights, varying methods, but a consistent pattern in all these states through the Cold War.
It does. And looking across this period, several key themes really stand out, cutting across the different regions.
Okay, let's unpack those cross-cutting themes up to the late 70s. The role of external power seems absolutely crucial and often detrimental.
Hugely significant, yes. As we've seen repeatedly, external support was almost always driven by the geopolitical goals of those powers, not genuine commitment to the Kurds. This instrumental approach led to manipulation and frequent abandonment. The British in Iraq, Soviets in Mahabad, the U.S. in Iraq in 75 are prime examples.
And it fueled internal conflict, too.
Absolutely. External powers often weaponized Kurdish factions, backing one against another, which just deepened the damaging internal divisions and made a unified strategy even harder to achieve.
Which brings us to those internal dynamics. Factionalism seems like a constant challenge.
A persistent and tragic one. It stemmed from so many things. Ideological fights, independence versus autonomy, traditional versus leftist approaches, leadership rivalries, the enduring power of tribal structures.
Tribal structures helped preserve identity but hindered unity.
Exactly. They preserved local identity but sometimes got in the way of broader national unity and made communities vulnerable to divide and rule tactics by states. And of course, just being split across four different countries created different priorities and strategies. This fragmentation, often exploited from outside, really defined the struggle.
Did the Arab-Israeli conflict play much of a role?
Indirectly, yes. Israel, under its periphery doctrine, gave some limited tactical support to Iraqi Kurds, Barzani's KDP, often coordinated with the Shah's Iran, mainly to weaken Arab states like Iraq. But that support was conditional and stopped after the Algiers Agreement. And perceived links to Israel were sometimes used by Arab states to try and delegitimize Kurdish demands more broadly. But Israeli engagement outside Iraq was pretty minimal in this period.
What about international bodies like the League of Nations or the UN? Were they any help?
Honestly, their role was very limited and largely ineffective for Kurdish self-determination. The League got involved in the Mosul question, stipulated some Kurdish rights in Iraq, but they were poorly implemented, lacked teeth.
Appeals didn't work.
Generally not. Zoibun appealed to the League about Ararat, but got nowhere. The UN, especially during the Cold War, prioritized state sovereignty and was dominated by superpower politics. So its role was marginal, reinforcing a Kurdish view of international indifference.
Finally, amidst all this political turmoil and repression, cultural nationalism seems incredibly important.
Absolutely fundamental. It was the bedrock for preserving Kurdish identity, language, heritage against aggressive assimilation policies. Despite suppression, there were continuous efforts within Kurdistan and in diaspora to maintain and develop the language, literature, folklore.
Like the standardization effort.
Yes, the Hawar alphabet was crucial. Publishing newspapers and journals like Kurdistan, Hawar, Rojanu, collecting oral traditions, setting up cultural groups whenever possible.
And periods of relative freedom, like in French Mandate Syria, were key.
Very key. Those moments allowed cultural work to flourish. This cultural resilience was vital for maintaining identity when political avenues were blocked, and it laid the groundwork for future mobilization.
So looking back at this journey up to the late 1970s, it's just incredibly complex, full of contradictions. This enduring quest for self-determination facing immense obstacles, state repression, shifting global politics, those internal divisions.
It really is. And those short-lived experiments in self-rule Mahabad, Ararat, Sheikh Mahmud's kingdom, they may have failed politically at the time, but they became powerful symbols. The cultural awakenings, the sheer persistence despite betrayals and fragmentation, it all speaks to the depth and resilience of Kurdish identity. The patterns we've discussed, the constant interplay of internal and external forces, the challenges of unity, the power of cultural identity, they provide absolutely crucial context for understanding everything that came next and indeed the ongoing Kurdish aspirations today.
It certainly makes you think about how these deep historical currents, these experiences of hope, betrayal, resistance, and division, continue to echo and shape the region and the Kurdish future. We'll leave you with that thought. How does this past, stretching up to the 70s, continue to influence the present and potentially the future for the Kurdish people?